This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From the COP27 climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, Paul Beckwith reports in. Paul is a Canadian climate scientist and the largest single science video provider on YouTube. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Alex.
So, over 35,000 people talking climate in a weird holiday venue. It must be strange. How is it going, Paul?
For me, it's going all right. It's place Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, so it's in the south coast of the Sinai Peninsula. The actual place reminds me a bit of Las Vegas because it's definitely a large resort town, but there's not like a main strip. Like in Las Vegas, it's all along the coastlines and it's very hot.
As a kind of resident climate scientist there, you were on all seven of the panel presentations set from the climate emergency folks.
I just finished attending some presentations in a section called the Cryosphere Pavilion, which was sort of my, you know, main hangout at the COPs as in previous years, because there's all kinds of good talks on the cryosphere. So glaciers on Greenland and on Antarctica, the sea ice at both poles, and the Himalayan glaciers and so on. So lots of really good sessions. And I just came from a session with Jason Box, who's the scientist probably most well-known for his work on Greenland.
And one presenter was Dr. Jem Bendel, and Jem is a well-known sustainability expert. He was hired by governments and presented keynotes at major conferences. Then after a deep dive into climate science, he became critical of academics who were putting a bright face on coming disaster. At this COP, Bendel released new stats showing the denialist hashtag #PoundClimateScam went from 3,000 tweets a month, most of the time, to almost 100,000 monthly posts just in time for the climate conference. But tags like, well, you know, #PoundClimateJustice lags far behind. What does Bendel is thinking is going on with this sudden surge of the climate scam thing again?
Yeah, that was a very interesting slide that he showed where he just did that assessment on that hashtag. And, you know, the only thing I can think of is if you look also at some previous COPs, I mean, there seemed to be a surge on the nonsense tweets and nonsense social media posts, you know, about a month or two before the COP is about to start. So I think it's just the right-wing climate denier fear, you know, sort of gearing up before major climate events. I think that's part of it. You know, along with the Climate Emergency Forum panels, which we had on a variety of topics, and today there were a couple particularly interesting ones on with the Center for Climate Repair at Cambridge, a group of scientists there that are working on, well, today's topic was ocean CDR, so methods in the ocean where you can remove carbon dioxide. The sessions are a mix of what's happening with the climate, what's happening with human response to the climate, you know, and different groups that are trying to do something about it, and also what sort of things can we do or on the sort of climate restoration front. You know, and I think that climate restoration will become bigger and bigger, but I mean, the focus at this COP is loss and damage. You know, the inequitability between the global north, who have created the vast bulk of the emissions, and the global south, who are bearing the brunt of some of the worst consequences of rapidly changing climate, mostly floods and droughts in other places, and, you know, rising sea levels will affect many countries there.
After his presentation, you had a sit-down with Jem Bendel. What did you talk about, and how would you characterize his mood?
So I basically asked him to kind of elaborate a bit on, he's known as, probably the most famous paper was on deep adaptation, the idea that we need to change our way of life to address the climate problem. Like, at just adapting to things, is you're being hit by things from all different directions, and you're just trying to dodge them for mitigation, and you're just trying to figure out how to be resilient when they hit you for adaptation. But it has to go much beyond that. We have to really change how we do things in society to change the results, which is to try to come back from the brink of abrupt climate system change. So it was a lot of details in that. We talked about a lot, you know, a bit about academia and and the insular ivy tower nature, where, you know, academics by nature are more and more specialized. And, you know, as you get more and more specialized, you know more and more about less and less. So, you know, and these aren't practical ways of dealing with climate system change. You need to understand how all the pieces are changing and have policies to step back from it. So I also had a half-hour session where I chatted with Peter Fiakowski and about his book, Climate Restoration, which was just published this year.
So I'm guessing you did not shake hands with Al Gore or celebrities or Joe Biden or anything?
Well, I did manage to do so with Al Gore, actually, and it was just kind of random. I was walking around one of the buildings where there's each country has a different booth, and I happened to notice a schedule saying that, you know, Al Gore is going to be speaking at 6 o'clock. And then I talked to him afterwards briefly. When he is totally against any idea of geoengineering, as he called it, totally against it. I said, well, what about climate restoration? Would you be against climate restoration? And, you know, by that time, there were swarms of people also asking questions, so I never got an answer to that. But, yeah, you do see people. I mean, and we see them at unusual times. Like last night, I was in an event. There was a free dinner and presentation at a 4-star hotel. I was talking to a Polish reporter from Warsaw, and he was with a group, you know, and he said, that's the mayor of Warsaw right there beside me. And I thought that was quite interesting, the mayor of Warsaw. And then a few minutes later, they all started to look very concerned and upset and started talking in Polish, and I didn't know what was going on, so a little while later I asked the reporter, well, what's happened? And he said some missiles have just gone into Poland, you know, and when they first hit, they thought it was Russian missiles. Some of the Polish people were clearly, visibly very, very upset. So we talked a little bit about the cop that was in Poland not too long ago, 2 years ago, in Katowice, Poland, and you know, about the influence that coal companies had on that conference. And people have probably read that, you know, there's more lobbyists here. There's a record number of fossil fuel lobbyists here. And actually the Canadian contingent, Canada has a pavilion, and where they've been giving a number of talks. And Alberta people had a session, which I recorded. I've got dozens of videos that I have to put up on my website. I find that the COP, there's so much packed into them that there's just no way I can keep. If I'm uploading videos, then I won't be taking more videos. You know what I mean? There's always something going on here. And the internet actually is being very flaky for me and extremely slow. And I did some speed tests with, you know, next to Jem, in fact. We were standing next to each other. My internet was terrible. His was fine. So I did speed tests, and my speed was almost nothing. You start getting a bit paranoid. You start wondering, well, Jem said, well, there's probably a list of like 100 activists, you know, that they just throttle their internet slower. So, you know, they do selective slowing of their internet just to frustrate people so that they can't post things. Climate activists, so I don't know if that's the case, but I do know there was a COP27 app, the official app from the UN on the conference, and that allowed the Egyptian government to know to actually access your phone and your camera so they could hear what you were saying. They could, they could see what was going on, and also they knew your location just from that COP27 app. And there were some articles on that before the conference. So I didn't download the app. But when you come into Egypt, you go to the phone company, Vodafone, and if you're with the COP, they give you a free Vodafone SIM card. You know, that has all that tracking capability on it, like the COP app. So they don't get you one way, they get you the other way. But, I mean, I've got nothing to hide, so it doesn't really bother me.
Well, let's make a fond hello to the government of Egypt, and please keep working on your own climate policies. Lots we could say about that. Have you seen any major climate pronouncements so far that you think could actually work?
The funny thing is the conference is so large. I have been around the entire thing. Like, I've seen the plenary rooms and I've seen the, main areas, and often, when the world leaders are in there discussing, then they're not open to the public. Like, it's very, there's very different levels of hierarchy in what you can get into and what you can't get into. I read the summary in The Guardian each evening and on what's happened at the COP. And, some of the things I know about, and but many of the things to do with the negotiations, et cetera, that's how I find out about them. It's not, unless you're in the meeting room, then, you just don't know. You have, I find out about a lot of really good events from, say, Nick Breeze, for example, who, he interviewed Catherine Hayhoe just yesterday, and I got to meet her, the evangelical climate scientist. Like, she's Canadian, but she's quite well known as a climate educator. It's a huge circus in a way. Like, it's nowhere near the most efficient way to get action done on climate. I mean, now let me turn around and ask you. I mean, have you come across much news on the COP in your neck of the woods in Vancouver?
Very, very little. It's not being covered on the television news at all. Although I have to say that I'm not seeking it out as much, since I'm a little bit pessimistic about what's really going to come out of this. You may be in the richest part of it, Paul, in the sense it may feel like voices in the wilderness, but actually you're meeting some of the people who do matter. I think Nick Breeze is one of them with Climate Gen. Climate Gen is just Climate, G-E-N-N. And he just did another really good interview with Jason Box, the glaciologist that I talked to on Radio EcoShock. And that gets us back to glaciology, which I know is one of your loves. And I think this is going to be key to the future of the world. People think it's extreme hurricanes and droughts and floods and heat. And it is all that. But sea level rise is going to rewrite the maps of our world and sink some of the most populous cities and coasts and all that. You've heard all that. So why do you think glaciology is coming to the fore now?
We're finding out more and more that the major ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica are nowhere near as solid as we thought. For example, on the sea level curves for the different scenarios of warming, from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, right, they have a sort of a band of curves rising upward sort of exponentially, but they're all still fairly low sea level rise by, say, 2100. And then they had a dashed line going up. Now, there was just a conference on a cryosphere conference in Iceland in August, and there were something like 200 or 300 scientists there, glaciologists and sea ice experts and people. And, one of the big presentations that they were all talking about was this curve of sea level, where the dashed line curve that was in there had something like 1 meter of sea level by 2070, and it went up to a couple meters by 2100, sort of in an exponential fashion. Now, years ago, I said, back of the envelope calculation, is it possible for us to have, say, 7 meters of sea level rise by 2070? And that's considered absurd, and it still is. But here's a curve that was presented at the conference in Iceland, where it was 1 meter by 2070. So they're getting closer to what I think will be the reality. Scientists don't tend to believe things unless there's a paper on it or multiple papers on it. I mean, another example is the warming rate of the Arctic relative to the global average, because it's always been in two and a half times, right? So all of the media articles, all of the scientists would say it's warming twice as fast, and yet you show them a curve that shows, hey, the warming is at least four times as fast, and because it's not published yet in a paper, they all parrot the number double. And now finally, just a few months ago, a paper came out, and it clearly shows it's four times faster temperature rise in the Arctic. So then you start hearing that a little bit in the media and stuff. I mean, even scientists, it takes a long time, because they're so specialized, they just take the word of other scientists, right? how the whole thing is built up. So it takes some time to actually readjust to data which shows things are much worse than they think. And that's true in just about all aspects of climate science. As you know, everything's happening faster than expected. Well, the expectations are completely wrong. You know, they're always on the conservative side. So, but I think the biggest effect coming at humanity in the short to mid-term is the extreme weather events are going to greatly accelerate. I mean, the idea of 1.5 degrees is absurd, and yet there's still people, you know, negotiators and stuff that are talking about this number. But at least now they're conceding, well, we'll probably pass, we probably can't hold the 1.5, but then they start talking about, well, we'll pass 1.5 for a short period of time, sort of, and then back it off. Well, tell me how that's going to happen. right now, you know, it's just not. I mean, the 2 degrees is probably gone too. So then you have to start thinking about 3 or 4 degrees, and, you know, there's not going to be a lot of ice on Antarctica and Greenland, but how long will it take for that ice to be lost? Well, the mechanisms, one of the reasons why the sea level rise dashed line was a meter by 2070 and 2 meters plus by 2100 is because of these different marine ice sheet instabilities. You know, one of them being water's heavier than ice. So water on the surface of the ice finds its way to the bottom of the ice. You know, it creates crevices, it creates cracks, it opens up moulins. It's, you know, warmer than the ice, so it's melting through like a drill. But we've known about that for a while, but it turns out that that can greatly accelerate the movement of the ice sheets towards the ocean. And we know that the removal and collapse of ice shelves are creating greatly increased rates of glacier flow, because it's like removing a cork from a bottle. We know that the intermediate water of the ocean is warming very, very large amounts, and it's very salty and warm, so it's not at the surface because it's denser than the surface water, which is colder and fresh. But that intermediate water is undercutting the glaciers, and there were some papers, you know, on East Antarctica where that was being measured, also on Thwaites Glacier, where they call it the Doomsday Glacier. So all of these things are happening. There's changes in the AMOC, the ocean circulation. There's more recognition in the scientific community that, hey, you know, really bad things can happen very quickly, and they really wouldn't acknowledge that possibility before. But now it's being talked about, at least, and scientists are starting to say, well, how do we have a formulation sort of for what can actually happen, you know, if these worst-case scenarios happen. And these are really sort of, they call them the fat tails, if you like, of the exponential distribution curve. But what I really think is going to happen is we're going to get simultaneous failure of the major food-producing regions of the world, you know, say in a decade, or, you know, 5 years, a decade, decade and a half. And this is going to cause global food shortages, spikes in prices. There's going to have to be a huge amount of money flowing from rich countries to poorer countries, or we're going to get mass starvation events in these poorer countries. I don't think we can avoid that sort of scenario.
We saw it once a little bit in 2010 when the Russian wheat crop failed, and that caused wheat prices to go up around the world, and then geopolitical unrest. So there's lots to talk about there. So as we finish up our time here, do you have any gossip or inspiration or interesting stories that you would like to pass on, Paul Beckwith?
I like Peter Fayakowski's view. So he's an engineer. He was a chip engineer, not the potato chips, but, you know, Silicon Valley developed companies that had imaging systems to image chips as they were, computer chips as they were being manufactured and processed, et cetera. And, you know, his products, the company's products were needed by many of the big producers. So that sort of set him up. And then, you know, he's had other business ventures. But he started being concerned about climate, and he found my videos, and he found people like you and your show, and he found, you know, the guy McPherson's, and he started investigating as an engineer would for himself, and he was very concerned about what he saw. So, you know, he's really switched his focus to, you know, what can we do about the climate issue? And so he talked about his book mostly in the half-hour interview, and I'm really assessing, you know, what his views are, and I've had some information from the Cambridge climate repair people, we had Sir David King was supposed to come and be on one of our panels, but he couldn't, so we had an 8-minute video that he made for the panel about, you know, the climate restoration sort of ideas. I mean, Peter's view is for a solution to be viable, it's got to be, one, it's got to be scalable, two, it's got to be permanent, and three, it's got to be self-financing. So it's got to generate some money. So there's four sort of solution areas he looks at. I mean, he really likes the idea of carbon capture in cement and carbon capture to make limestone, because there's a market for limestone and cement. You obviously, you know, huge demand in the world, you know, huge amounts of mining going on. And if we don't need to dig up the materials, then we can mass produce them, but with carbon that we capture from the air. And then that's, you know, it fits the requirements, those three requirements that I said. And the idea of growing massive amounts of kelp in the ocean, not just on coastlines, but in surface, you know, deep ocean areas with obviously you need platforms, things like that.
From COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, we have been speaking with Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. You can track Paul's latest videos on his YouTube channel or his website, paulbeckwith.net. And I'll put links in my show blog, of course, at ecoshock.org. Paul, it's great to talk with you, and please keep your head above the crowd and come back to us safe.
Okay, well, thank you. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, Alex.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.